Well, this morning, you may have noticed we jumped into the middle of a story, so we're going to give a little precursor to this story so you know where we're at, which means there won't be any catchy introduction or any, award-winning jokes like I normally have that really, really wow this particular congregation. We do enter chapter 30 this morning immediately after David has been sent home by the Philistines. You'll remember that David has been hiding out from Saul among the Philistines. He has entrenched himself so deeply into their world that he has become, quite literally, the bodyguard or the keeper of the head of the king of the Philistines. The last time we saw this group, they were lining up against Saul and Israel, and David was among their warriors as they were leading out to battle. In the chapter that precedes the one we read this morning, as David's sitting there in the front lines with the people as they're ready to go to war against King Saul and the nation, some shrewder fellows among the Philistines notice David. They remember him. They know him pretty well. And they have some questions for the king, like, what's with the Hebrews? They literally ask that question. Why are these Jewish guys going with us to fight against their own people? This seems like it could have some built-in downside. And Achish, who is shown to be an extreme fool in this text, responds, this is literally what he says, is this not David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel? This is his defense for why David's there. To which the men respond like, yeah, listen to yourself. Is this not David, the servant of Saul, the guy we're going to fight, the future king of Israel? Like, what do you think he's going to do when we get there? And they say what their concern is. They say, we are afraid that he will start to take our heads in the midst of battle. They know David. They even remind Achish. They're like, you know the song. It's playing on all the radios, even in Philistia. You know, Saul has killed his thousands, but David, his tens of thousands. And the tens of thousands that are being referenced in that song are mostly Philistines. And so these guys are saying, you know, this guy is pretty renowned for taking heads, Goliath in particular, one of our own. He's become famous because he's killed so many people in battle, our people being, 200 of the first that really came under his sword. It is not wise for him to go into battle with us. And so Achish loses the argument, and he somewhat, you know, sheepishly goes back to David and says, you know, I tried. I'm not sure why, but these guys just don't want you to come with us. But I mean, I've got no qualms with you. And David, as he continues to play Achish for the fool that he is, plays along with the charade, and in his disappointment says one of the most wonderfully ambiguous lines in all of Scripture. He says, why can't I go and fight? I want to fight against the enemies of my Lord and my king. You know, of course, the question is, which Lord and which king? David surely would have played the spoiler of the Philistines. He has spared Saul several times to now. He's not going to turn on him at this point in the story. And so the Philistines wisely send David home. And so they go on this three-day journey. And that is where we find them in our text this morning. And the first thing I want us to see is an endangered kingdom. You'll notice David and his 600 men have just walked over desert terrain for about 60 to 80 miles. And weary, ready to see their wives and their children, you know, they crest the last hill only to see the whole of their encampment in Philistia Ziklag set to fire, you know, smoldering in ruins. The Amalekites have burned down their city. It says they carried off all their women and all of their children. And we learn graciously that everyone's still alive. And while that may give you some hope, if you know who the Amalekites are, they aren't being kept alive, you know, to be given a prosperous life. These children and wives will become slaves and concubines to the people of Amalek. You know, we see really pointedly, the author wants us to know David's own family is among them. Two of David's wives have also been taken along with his children. And our text says that all the men just fell down and wept, David included. You know, he shares in the suffering of all of his men. I mean, you can imagine the emotional blow that this would be, especially when you're this physically tired. You know how much easier it is to get weak and even at times potentially weepy when you're, you know, have had enough, you're exhausted, and then that last shoe drops. You know, maybe on the move, the car breaks down. You know, those kind of things. You know, you just finish an arduous journey that has spent you physically. Your hopes really are set for home. You know, a hot meal, a shower, that's a bit anachronistic, a bath, time with your wife and your family. The emotional anticipation is high. Your physical exertion has been high, only to arrive and to realize that everything is gone. Some of you have read the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and some of you are just learning right now that they are books and not just films. But in the second to last chapter, which is skipped, it's barely referenced in the film, it's done horribly, at least in reference to this particular chapter, you see a very similar occurrence take place. You know, if you've read the books, and especially if you've read them as a young person, you understand the emotional impact of this particular scene in the scouring of the Shire. You know, you've journeyed with these particular characters all the way to Mordor. You've faced every possible hardship along the way, and you've had tons of scenery described to you. You're tired from the journey of reading these books because they are quite long. You know, the One Ring has been destroyed, restoring hope to all of the realms. You've walked all the way back home to the Shire. The whole reason you were fighting to begin with was to save this place that you left behind, only to get home and to see that it has been completely industrialized, deforested. It's overrun, what turns out to be by Saruman, and your people have become enslaved all while you're out doing, you know, this heroic thing on their behalf. I mean, it is almost, even as a reader, too much to bear. Like, we've gone through too much to get to this point. And that's exactly what is happening here in our text. That is why these men are weeping in concert. You know, all that David has been fighting for, the preservation of the kingdom of Israel, the continuation of her holy seed, the restoration of him and his family to the throne, is now threatened. And this is clearly a plot from the evil one. I mean, all the way back to the beginning of Scripture, this has always been the theme. How do we get rid of God's people and their seed? And so we know that behind Amalek, there is a much greater enemy at work. The Amalekites, of course, are notorious, but they are a threat that could have been and should have been dealt with already in 1 Samuel. Remember, these are the people that Saul was told to eliminate completely. And instead of eliminating them completely, he kept their king around, he kept some of their nice livestock, and it was for these reasons that the kingdom was torn from him, but it is also why they are now here wreaking havoc once again on God's people. And the Amalekites are known for their brutality. I mean, it's why God commanded them to be wiped out to begin with. The original command becomes because the Amalekites, on the day that Israel was exodus from Egypt, as they were headed toward the promised land, the Amalekites went around the rear of the people, where all the stragglers were, the weak and the weary, those who are most defenseless, and destroyed those people in Israel. And God says, because of the way that they acted, I want them destroyed from all the earth. And here again, notice they attack a defenseless city. All the men are away, about to go to war. And so this is the time to take women and children and possession. And later in the text, we're going to meet one of their own. You saw him in our text, an odd thing. You know, this Egyptian slave who's owned by an Amalekite. And what happens? He gets ill as they're going on this raid. And the guy just says, like, too bad for you. Leaves him to die without food or water or shelter, just exposed. And it's like, well, you're expendable. And these are the people that now possess the wives and children of the Israelites. And this is why they're weeping. And in their emotion, you'll notice they begin to turn on David. This is one thing that is yet to happen in our text. David suffered all kinds of things. He's suffered enemies from without. He has suffered the betrayal of Saul. But now these loyalists, even they begin to turn on him. And the question that the author really wants to put before us, especially the way this text is situated, is what is David going to do? Everything is against him. It's hit his own home and family, and now those closest to him are turning on him. What is he going to do in this great time of need and anxiety? You know, will he wait till dark and go in disguise and find a witch, you know, to tell him his next moves? What is it like for a man after God's own heart? What will he do? And the contrast between him and Saul couldn't be any more stark in this text. And so you'll notice the second thing, a dependent king. Our text says, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Everyone is against him, and David turns to God, and he finds strength there. You know, we talked about last week that one of Saul's biggest problems is that he wouldn't stay weak. You'll notice David is strong here. He has been strengthened by God, but notice what he does with his strength. Once he's strengthened by the Lord, the next thing he does is he inquires of the Lord. In his strength, he uses that strength to turn in prayer to God, to cast all of his anxieties on God, all of the fears that he has. He inquires, Lord, what should I do in this particular situation? This is a man after God's own heart. This is a better man to lead God's people and God's economy, according to the text. And so let me ask you, dear church, this morning, and those things that are looming large on the horizon of your life, those things that keep you up at night, the things that make you anxious, that cause you much stress. I mean, are we like Saul, busy about trying to control and fix and solve, or have we taken those things genuinely to the Lord in prayer? Have we used our strength to humble ourselves once again under the mighty hand of God and to say to him, you are my portion and my shield, and in you will I trust in my hour of need. David, as we will see, is not like the previous king of Israel. He's dependent, wholly dependent on his God. And that is where he finds his strength. And the last thing, and I know this always gets people excited, so if I get there this quick, you know this is a long point, is he's a generous king. Notice David gets the information he needs as he inquires from the Lord. And now it's time to fight. And he's letting the men, know what is next, and they begin on their journey, the 600, we find that they get, starting out on their initial quest, that 200 just say, we can't do it. We're too exhausted from the previous 3 days' hikes. We don't have the strength to go down to the valley and rise up again and to go out to battle with you. I mean, one third of the army literally says, we can't go. And the army's already small. I mean, what would you do as the commander of a force like this? I mean, what would you say when you're already sorely outnumbered and that which is most precious to all of you has been taken is on the other side of that valley? I mean, it is interesting that David grants their request. And the text just sweeps right over it. David just says, like, all right, well, I guess we're leaving you here, and moves on. He clearly looks on them with compassion. We'll see that by the end of the text. He sees their need, and instead of driving them forward mercilessly, he says, okay, you can stay behind. I mean, how could he possibly do this? I mean, what would Saul do in the situation? We already saw him in battles where he made his men swear that they not eat while they were fighting, so much so that he took an oath that jeopardized his own son's life. I mean, just a foolish and rigorous king who only asks and demands of his people even things that they're unable to, even the things he's unable to give. But the reason that David's able to do this is that he believes what God says. He believes that the battle actually belongs to the Lord. He inquired of the Lord, and the Lord said, you're going to get everything back. I'm going out with you in battle today. And he knows that if God's going with them, if the numbers are small or great, that is completely beside the point, that God is on our side. I mean, he is a young man, has already defeated a giant. He has seen what God can do when he desires the destruction of his enemies. And therefore, because of that, you'll notice David, as ruler, doesn't need to seek to control or manipulate or abuse or misuse his people. He's merciful to those who are weak. He shows compassion to those who are unable. He doesn't shame them for their weakness because he knows that his confidence isn't in the numbers or in his men, but it's in the God that he serves. So now he goes with the 400, and immediately you'll notice it's odd. They happen upon this poor chap left for dead in the desert. And you know, the Hebrew text, if you're a Hebrew Bible reader, the inordinate amount of time it spends on this one slave is very strange for the amount of things that are skipped over in one verse in the Old Testament. But before knowing who he is, you'll notice, what does David do? He has no clue this guy is going to be an asset to him militarily. He stops his quest and feeds him, quenches his thirst, even gives him dessert, you know, figs and raisins, which is a pretty big deal in that day. And it says, and then when revived, refreshed, this wounded soul left for dead, weary and weak, almost like on the side of the road, like a parable we've seen in the New Testament, when he's brought back to life and revived, he tells them his story, that he belongs to an Amalekite. And David says, hey, will you show me where they're at? And he says, if you swear that I don't have to go back to them. And this will be one of many odd, weak, outcast characters that David collects into his army and brings in among the flock of his own people. When one is not relying on their own strength, when one believes that the battle belongs to the Lord, when one really thinks that God can win by many or by few, and it doesn't matter, it doesn't take all the smart, most talented, you know, all the pretty people, it doesn't take, you know, our own, you can collect the least and the lost and the losers and those who don't quite add up in the world's economy, which is why the church's door should be wide open to whoever comes. Whoever comes to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord is added to God's kingdom and is counted as one of the faithful. But if you think that God's work depends on our strength and our wisdom, you know, our acumen and, you know, our winsomeness, then what you have to do is start, you know, putting aside the unseemly ones and making sure that they don't get shown out in public. You know, we only, you know, proselytize the rich and the wise and the shrewd, those who have made it on this side of things. But you'll notice that's not the king's way in the Old Testament. He collects a slave who is nearly starving to death, and he gives him the time of day in his compassion. And the story of the battle, interestingly enough, is pretty short. They will spend more time talking about all the gifts that David gives away than the fighting that takes place, which is pretty strange. But not only is it short, it reads odd. It's written as if David went out and single-handedly fought everyone by himself. Did you notice that? It never once says anything about his troops. It just says David. 25 times David's name is mentioned in these verses. Notice David fought, verse 17. David recovered everything, verse 18. David brought it all back, verse 19. This is David's plunder, verse 20. I mean, David clearly is the headline here. He is outdoing, he's doing it as if he did it all by himself. And while that's literally probably not true, literally, that is exactly what the author wants you to see. This is David's victory. David fights on his own. And we're told that David was able to recover every single thing that was taken. Nothing was lost to the enemy. Nothing was used and not recovered. And while the battle and the success is clearly credited to David, it is interesting that David's distribution of gifts gets front page news. There's something about the gift giving that the author wants you to see. And it tells us something about who this king is and why he is so much better, so much more highly prized than Saul. You notice once the battle's over, they come back home and it's time to divvy up the spoils of war. You know, who's going to get what? And maybe you heard the complaint of the 400. Maybe you were sitting there with them agreeing, like, yeah, this does not seem to make a lot of sense. And they say, you know, the 400 guys that went and fought said, yeah, they can have their wives and kids back. That's fine. But they can't have any of this other stuff. I mean, they didn't even go with us. How are they going to get the prizes of war if they weren't out fighting the war? You only get what you work for, right? And of course, David disagrees sharply, and we're going to notice the largesse of this king, his graciousness. It's based on the same reality of his compassion that he shows elsewhere in this text. First, you'll notice that David, the text calls it David's spoil. It's his. In one sense, it all belongs to him. He doesn't have to share it with anybody if he doesn't want. But notice how David speaks about the spoils. He says, this victory was God's. God went out and fought for us. Therefore, everything belongs to whom? It's all God's possession. Therefore, no one has claim on it because it's all graciously given. And so David says, no, it will be equally distributed. Those who went out and fought will get the same as the amount of those who stayed home among the baggage. And it says his law was so wise and persuasive that it became the standing law in Israel from this day forward. That the way of this king and the way of this kingdom is different than our natural way of thinking, than the way that we would do it, the way that it's always been done. And this becomes, you'll notice, this rising king has a new law that will be eternal, an eternal statute in the land. And notice, in this kingdom, the math of David's rule is quite different than the math of Saul's rule. What we may call, you know, natural reaction by the men who seem to work harder. I mean, I sympathize with them. Notice what the text views them as. It says, there were some worthless and wicked men who stood up and said, we shouldn't have to share with those who didn't work. You know, the Bible views things just a smidge different than we do in our normal way of thinking. You know, this text shows us a grand picture of the king of Israel, the one who's about to arise to the throne, and it's doing it on purpose. You'll notice it is surrounded by a text where Saul goes and talks with the witch, and then the next text will be where Saul gets his head chopped off by the enemy. That there is a king that we've been watching throughout the entirety of the book of Samuel, and his ways do not work in God's kingdom. And then there's this king right in the middle of this text, and everything he's doing is supposed to be shaping our minds for what we want in a king who will rule over us. A king who will join us in our sufferings. A king who is dependent upon God above all else. A king who is so full of compassion that he stops for the weak and the wounded and gives generously to those who didn't earn their keep. I mean, the king that Israel wanted was a Saul. They wanted a king just like the nations had, and they got a king just like the nations. A king who takes and takes and takes. You remember when Samuel described it? He said, you want a king? Here's what he's going to do. He's going to take your daughters. He's going to take your sons. He's going to take your... And that's exactly what Saul does. He just takes everywhere that he can. And then we have David here in this text. Once he's gone and collected everything back, what does he do? He gives and he gives and he gives. He gives as if you were fighting side by side with him, whether you were there or not. And we see in this the kind of king that could make Israel a better people than they were. Somehow they could become more than they were if they had a king like this. And of course, we can't help but see a foretaste of our own king. A king who once saw us enslaved to the enemy, who came and fought a battle in order to free his bride. Ever dependent on the Father's will, ever patient under his hand, even if that hand led him to the brutality of a cross. A king who literally, not just literarily, did it all. He lived the life we couldn't live. He died the death that we deserve. He rose for our vindication. He literally has done everything to where he can say over the entirety of a life, it is finished. All is accomplished. There is no condemnation. You are righteous in God's sight. He did all of the obeying, all of the suffering, all of the dying, all of the rising, and even now all of the reigning. He led captivity captive, and he gave and he gave and he gave gifts to his church. I mean, this victor, King Jesus, has shared with you the spoils of his victory. And brothers and sisters, you weren't there to lift a finger. You know, Luther was right. All we contributed to our salvation was sin and resistance. Everything else has been done by this one, and now he gives you everything that he's won. He gives you his very own righteousness. He gives you the Spirit of God as your own possession and deposit. He gives you his very own holiness. He gives you his resurrection that says to you, whatever's happening in this life, it is not final. He's even given you his name. What manner of love the Father has given unto us that we should be called sons of God. I mean, this one, he says to the one who came to work in the last hour, you won't go home with anything less than the one who got here at the crack of dawn. He says to the one who fights on the front lines that you won't outrank the ones who sat with the baggage. There will be no room for boasting or one-upmanship because he did everything. What is there for us to boast about if it's all of grace? As Paul has told us, what do you have that you did not receive as a gift? And if you received it as a gift, why do you boast as if it wasn't given to you? I mean, what do you have to brag about? Nothing is yours. It's all his that's been given to you by gift and grant. And if that makes you frustrated, then you don't quite get the gospel yet, because this should make your heart full. Even to the wicked and worthless, it said, we want more. They got an equal distribution, because God knows who you are. He knows what you've done. He knows that your strength is small. And even the times you succeed, that wasn't you. That was a gift too. By the power of his Spirit, he has helped you to walk in obedience. So there's no room for boasting, but there's so much room for praise and gratitude and glory to the one who has made all, rules all, and owns all. So to him be the glory forever and ever, because this is your king. These are the ways of his kingdom. May we be grateful that they are, for we wouldn't have made it any other way. And may we learn to walk in his gracious ways. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Let's pray.